It was a race against death now. Pitt calls Giardino over the portable radio. You can knock off the search and call in the inspectors. The explosives are not inside the ship. He turned to Baldwin, who was standing with O'Malley at the control console with the helmsman. How soon before we pass into shallow water?
20 minutes will put us over the edge of the trench and onto the continental slope, Baldwin answered,
his face beginning to show signs of stress now that he had come to believe his boat was truly in danger.
And 10 more minutes we'll reach the surface, which will enable us to increase our speed by half and reach shallow water.
Abruptly, the seaman standing at the ship's main console called out,
Captain, something is happening with the evacuation pods.
Baldwin and O'Malley stepped over and stared at the console in shock. All 16 lights of the evacuation pods were showing red, except for one that still read green.
They've been activated, Baldwin gasped.
And before anyone could board, added O'Malley grimly, we'll never get the crew and passengers off the boat now.
Pitt knew that whoever had activated the evacuation pods had probably abandoned the boat in one of them, which meant that the explosives could detonate at almost any moment. He stepped over to the radar screen that sat by the side scan sonar display. The continental slope was rising, but too slowly. Suddenly the boat shuddered with sickening violence. Those great, technically advanced engines wound down to a stop as the hungry sea poured into the 2 wounds caused by the underwater explosives. The Golden Marlin lay motionless, drifting in the mild current, but sinking foot by inexorable foot toward the seafloor. Baldwin snapped to his second officer,
"Call the engine room and ask the chief to ascertain the damage."
The reply came back almost immediately.
The chief engineer reports they're taking water in the engine room. The baggage compartment is also flooding, but the hull is still intact. He has the pumps flowing at maximum capacity. He also reports that the ballast tank pump system was damaged and water is pouring into the tanks through the exhaust tubes. The crew is struggling to shut down the flow, but the water is rising fast and they may have to evacuate the engine room. I'm sorry, sir, the chief says he can no longer keep the boat from losing neutral buoyancy.
Baldwin quickly came on keel.
Tell the chief to close all the watertight doors below and keep the generators going as long as he can.
Then he looked at Pitt, silent, expressionless, and said,
Well, Mr. Pitt, I guess now's the time for you to tell me I told you so.
Pitt shook his head slowly. I take no satisfaction in being right.
Bottom coming up.
First Officer Conrad's eyes had never left the radar and side-scan sonar displays. He had no sooner spoken than the Golden Marlin struck the seafloor with loud creaking and groaning sounds of protest as her hull settled into the silt, throwing up a vast brown cloud. Captain Baldwin and his officers began studying emergency procedures that came out of corporate manuals written by those who had no concept of how to deal with a submarine cruise liner lying helpless on the bottom with 700 souls on board. Together, Pitt, Giardino, and O'Malley went down to the evacuation pod deck. O'Malley began opening inspection panels and checking the system.
Whoever activated the evacuation pods knew his business, he sighed. He overrode the circuits leading to the bridge and set the pods in motion by using the emergency manual controls. Luckily, it looks like one pod failed to release.
An hour later, a Coast Guard cutter arrived on the scene and opened communications to the boat. Only then did Baldwin give the command to gather the passengers into the theater and explain the situation. Pitt and O'Malley sat at a computer in the purser's office and estimated the number of bodies the pod could carry beyond the safe limits, as stated by the manufacturer, and still float free to the surface.
There are 27 mothers on board, O'Malley said with a hint of optimism. Thank God we can evacuate all of them and their children.
We have to ignore the new tradition of keeping families together, said Pitt. The men make up too much weight.
I agree, O'Malley said heavily.
We have to send one of us, Pitt said, who can give a detailed report on the situation down here.
Giardino returned at that moment.
"Kelly has disappeared," he said. "I put together a search party, but we can find no trace of her."
"Bloody hell!" Pitt swore.
Suddenly, the photo of a passenger filled his mind. He programmed in the passenger list on the computer and typed the name Jonathan Ford. The picture of Ford, taken as he stepped off the gangway onto the deck, filled the monitor. Next, Pitt hit the print key and waited until a colored image rolled from the printer. While O'Malley and Giardino stood silent, he studied the face, comparing it mentally with the pilot of the Red Fokker. He took the image over to a desk, took a pencil, and began shading in the man's face. When he was finished, he felt as if a fist had struck him in the stomach.
"He was here on board, and I missed him."
Completely adrift, O'Malley asked, "Who are you talking about?"
"The man who nearly killed me along with a plane load of children in New York, and the one responsible for us lying helpless on the bottom. I'm afraid that he escaped in one of the evacuation pods and took Kelly with him."